Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Humane Podcast, your tech insider podcast on the data economy. From the physical circuit chips on your smartphone to the software powering GPT models, we live in a data-first world. Humane interviews the founders, investors, executives, and tech leaders that are creating the world that we live in for consumers and enterprises. Welcome back, listeners. Introducing Humane, the Tech Insider podcast on the data economy. From the physical circuit chips on your smartphone to the software powering GPT models, we live in a data-driven world. Humane interviews the founders, investors, executives, and leaders that are creating the world that we live in for consumers and the enterprise. And today we're featuring our guest, who is Seth Dobrin. He is the co-founder and GP of One Infinity Ventures. He is also an author of his new book release, AI IQ for a Human-Focused Future. And for those who don't know, Seth is definitely one of the leaders in the AI and data science space. Seth, such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah, David, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak with your listeners.
Of course. And maybe to start us off, you know, you are a new author, and we're going to definitely dive into the new book that you got coming out, talking all about AI and what is IQ and this human-focused future. But before that, you know, we've collaborated over the years. I know our paths have crossed, and I'd love to hear what you've been up to and what are you focused on primarily these days?
Yeah, so I left IBM as their chief AI officer in September 2022, and I started a consulting company called Quantum AI that focuses on AI strategy, AI governance, and AI education, focused primarily on Fortune 500 companies and governments around the world. And then beginning of this year, I launched a venture fund called One Infinity Ventures and Silicon Sand Studios, which is a venture studio associated with it, focused entirely on deep tech responsible AI, and that's technologies that enable responsible AI development, but also AI that's developed responsibly. Also going around the world, you know, doing speaking gigs and things like that.
Love that. Well, we have a big passion for responsible AI on the show. We've featured a lot of startups that are building in that space, like Comet ML and Weights and Biases and Pinecone and others. So really excited to have you and your thought leadership here today. And you know, you're building a ton of great things, I'm sure, with startups and ventures. But first and foremost, right, we're thinking about strategy, talent, and culture. What does the future look like? And this is your book, AI IQ for a Human-Focused Future. Throughout the episode, I'd like to dive into some of the concepts you talk about in the chapters to give our listeners a sneak peek of, you know, what you've built and what you've learned about in all these large, incredible organizations that you partner with. So maybe before I dive into some specific questions, love to hear from your side, what inspired you for, you know, coming out with this new book and releasing it at this time?
Yeah, so I started using data and AI to transform companies back in 2006 when I was in Monsanto. So I led the data and AI transformation of what was probably one of the first two successful transformations of a Fortune 500 company at Monsanto, the other one being Capital One. And so, you know, I've been doing this for almost 20 years now. And over the course of the last 20 years, I've developed a methodology both at Monsanto and then later at IBM, both transforming IBM as well as working with, you know, many of IBM's customers, which is the Fortune 1000, essentially, developing and honing a methodology in how to successfully implement AI and generative AI in the enterprise. And my goal was to put it down onto paper. And so that's what the book is about, you know, kind of what the methodology is, how I approach it, what the requirements are, all the way down to how you measure it and what types of organization I think you need to support it. And so that was really the goal and the thought process and the objective was to put into words how I approach these things.
And of course, there's been a ton of change since 2006 and as the industries ebbed and flowed into different waves. So let's take a look at some of the high-level concepts that you cover in the book that I think will be very imperative for our listeners. One of them, just to get us started, you know, you talk about in a few chapters describing early corporate AI initiatives that sometimes they were described as a scam. So I'd like to hear from you. What were some of the biggest mistakes companies made, and how can leaders avoid repeating them with this new wave of Gen AI development?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I talk about that in the book, and I still talk about that today, right? So the first couple of years I was at IBM, I flew around the world talking to many of their customers. And this was in 2017, 2018. And this was when, you know, the data science, quote unquote, was the hype, right? And everyone was building data science teams and implementing data science teams. And it became evident to me that no one was getting value. Very few companies were getting value from it. So I started talking about it as being a scam, because everyone was putting tens of millions, or in some cases more money than that, into these teams and getting little to no value from the teams. The reason for it really came down to one or two things, and it came down to why they built the teams. A lot of times that they built the teams because, and I would kind of say it tongue in cheek, right? They'd go to a conference, they'd sit down next to one of their buddies and they'd say, you know, how many data scientists do you have? And they'd say 100, and they'd go back to their team and they'd say, go hire 101 data scientists. They didn't have a strategy. It wasn't tied to business value. There was no real objective for the team. They would hire the team and say, go forth and conquer. And you wouldn't approach any other investment in business really that way, right? If you're an oil and gas company, you wouldn't go drop a oil rig in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, or an oil well in the middle of nowhere in Alaska or in Texas, without doing some research, having a strategy, knowing how you're going to get returns, knowing what the likelihood of returns were. You know, you wouldn't build a manufacturing plant to build a widget if you didn't have some kind of idea if a person was going to buy the widget, right? But that's really how companies were approaching AI, machine learning back then, what we called machine learning back then. And so that's why I talk about it as being a scam. And I think to a certain extent, or to a large extent, companies are approaching, from what I can tell, generative AI the same way. Many companies are starting to do generative AI projects for the wrong reason. They're doing it because the board is telling them to, and they're just going and saying, where can we find out where we can apply generative AI? They're doing it because the CEO says we should do it, and there's no fixed strategy. It's not tied to business value. And in my consulting business, when someone calls me and says, hey, can you help me do, you know, figure out where to apply generative AI? You know, I say, sure. But then when I show up, I tell them they're asking the wrong question. The right question is really, what are your business objectives, right? And what are you beholden to your shareholders, whether it's Wall Street or anyone else? And how can technology accelerate you achieving those objectives? Inevitably, data, AI, and generative AI will be part of the solution, but it shouldn't start with that.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Having worked building data products myself, I always tell people, what's the use case, right? What are you actually solving for, not just the technology? So it makes a lot of sense. And in addition, Seth, you know, in the book, you emphasize aligning AI with business strategy. And perhaps that's going on a little bit of what you just shared. Can you further share an example, perhaps, of a company that's done this exceptionally well?
I think there's a few companies that have done this exceptionally well, and you can tell, you know, in the results. And so if you look at companies that have really been successful at implementing AI broadly across the enterprise, and the first one I'm going to talk about is from looking from the outside. I've never worked with them on this, but, you know, Bloomberg, right? Michael Bloomberg lives and dies by data and AI. Data is and AI are part of integral to their strategy, but it really is not a strategy in and of itself. It helps to support the company's overall business strategy, and it's an accelerant for the business strategy. And you can see that in the returns, you can see that in the products they sell, you can see that in how they operate as a business. And so I think that's a really good example where data and AI are core to a business strategy, but it's not finding a place for data. It's where the business strategy, you know, data and AI are part of the business strategy. There's other examples where you can look at, say, you know, there's governments that have done a really good job of integrating, building a strategy for helping their citizens have better interactions with the government using data and AI. Good example of that is Estonia. So the Estonian government, you know, that's an entirely digital government. And it's the whole point is to, you know, make sure that the citizens can interact in a meaningful way with the government, and do it in a way that is easy and productive, but it's all built around a singular strategy, and then data and AI are part of the solution. So it wasn't, you know, how do we use AI to make our citizens' lives better? It's how do we make our citizens' lives better? And then data and AI were part of it. And so you can see how there's a consistency there where you're using the strategy first and not the technology first.
Yeah, I think this is so important, thinking about the entire holistic view. And perhaps this entire holistic view is part of the concept that you introduce in the book. You introduce this concept called AI IQ. Tell us a little bit more about this, and how can organizations practically measure and improve their AI IQ over time?
You know, when you think about how you assess where you are, and I think that's a really important aspect of any journey, is kind of figuring out where you are and understanding what your gaps are. And so part of any good journey is knowing where you're starting and where you need to go. And so I've developed a very straightforward assessment that measures across a few dimensions that I call the AI IQ. And it looks at, you know, your organizational readiness, your architectural readiness, infrastructure readiness, your data readiness, your AI readiness / Gen AI readiness, and then your compliance readiness. And you get scored across all those, and it weights different questions different ways. And it helps you to understand what areas you need help in, what areas you're strong in, and really, really what you need to do to get where you need to go. And there's no right or wrong score. What score you need is different for every organization, but it's good to know where you are. It's also good to have some self-awareness for your organization. And this is not just an assessment that the C-suite takes. It should be done deep into the organization. And oftentimes when organizations have taken this, it's interesting, a lot of organizations overestimate their capacity, and a lot of organizations underestimate their capacity. And so it's kind of interesting. I actually expected most organizations to overestimate their capacity, but many more actually underestimate what they have in their organization. And so the AI IQ is essentially just an understanding of where you are and being mindful of that as you're on your journey.
I love having systems and frameworks. And it's so great to hear, you know, you building AI IQ with that mental model in mind. And in fact, there might be different stakeholders at companies that are focused on leading these efforts. Of course, you know, you've become quite famous over the years being one of the foremost leaders in the role of Chief AI Officer. And so you also feature in the book the role of Chief AI Officer prominently. How do you see this role evolving as AI becomes more ubiquitous in organizations?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably biased, having been one of the first chief AI officers, but I think it's really important that every organization have a chief AI officer, whether it's named individual or not. But I think chief AI officer at a minimum needs to be responsible for a handful of things. So one is the overarching strategy that we discussed. So how do you connect the business strategy to the AI effort? So making sure that AI just doesn't happen randomly in the organization, and owning the KPIs that are associated with that. So one of the big benefits of having your AI and data efforts tied to business strategy is those business strategies can often be distilled down to decisions, and each decision can actually be distilled down to dollars and cents. And so you can actually quantify the value you're driving from each implementation of AI. So the chief AI officer should be accountable for that. So what is the business value they're driving in dollars and cents? The chief AI officer should be responsible for talent across the organization, defining what talent needs, defining, ensuring diversity of the talent across the organization, ensuring the appropriate skill levels, education, retention, engagement, education, everything like that across. So all aspects of AI talent across the organization, whether they report to her or not. They should also be responsible for compliance. You know, we're in the AI space, we're in this world of, you know, ever growing compliance and regulation, whether you're in a regulated industry or not. The EU AI Act just passed. There's multiple regulations coming into effect or proposed in the US at different state levels, probably at the federal level. You have the executive order in the US. Around the world, you have other regulations being proposed. The chief AI officer is one of two people in my mind that should be accountable for compliance. The other person is the chief privacy officer or someone with legal background, but two in a box kind of thing. And they should run some kind of AI governance board in an organization together to make sure that the organization stays within bounds of what that organization believes and what is regulatorily required by policy within the organization. The other thing is to really make sure that there's the voice at the senior leadership level. So much like cybersecurity has a voice, AI needs to have a voice at that senior leadership or even board level, because it is that critical of a subject these days. And so I think at a bare minimum, those are the things that the chief AI officer needs to be responsible for. And depending on the organization, you could add other things on there. If it's a software organization, or for instance, you know, they should probably be the technical expert in the field as well, you know, driving all the technical decisions, helping figure out where, you know, what's the next big thing in technology and in AI that they should be investing in, things like that. So it depends on what the organization is, what other areas the chief AI officer should play in. But at a minimum, those are the things. Oh, oh, oh,
O'Reilly. You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people. Oh, 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 O'Reilly
Auto Parts. And that makes a lot of sense. And some undertones I heard there, Seth, is about governance. And this has been probably one of the biggest topics in 2024, which is around data and AI governance. You've discussed in the book specifically about how critical the importance of data quality is for AI success. Would you have any specific advice for companies struggling with poor data governance on how to improve?
Well, I have a couple points on that. So one is, organizations tend to struggle with governance for a couple of reasons. First is they see governance kind of as a hindrance. And actually, if you do governance right, it actually is an accelerant, because it enables people to do things quicker because they know what the boundaries are. And if you give people a place to focus, they know where they can innovate. And so as long as the governance boundaries are set up clearly and concisely, and there's places that you can, you know, clear channels of communication if you're up against those bounds and you don't know if you need to, what you're supposed to do, if you have a place where you can escalate to quickly, then governance actually can be an accelerant instead of a speed bump or a roadblock. So that's one thing. The other aspect is, when you look at specifically around data, oftentimes when companies approach data governance and data quality, particularly in the context of AI, they approach it as we need to clean up our data before we can do AI. And I actually prefer if people look at the use case that they're trying to address. So start with the strategy again. What is the particular use case that you're doing? What is the data that's required? And what type of data quality do you need for that use case? Because for every use case, you don't need perfect data. And so in some use cases, your data may need to be, you know, at 99% perfect quality. Other use cases, 90 could be good enough. And, you know, it costs money to get close to 100% in anything. You know, also when you're talking about, you know, not just accuracy of your data or completeness of your data, but also timeliness of your data. Do you need real-time data? Do you need, you know, can you, what kind of latency can you tolerate around your data? Difference between real-time data and a tenth of a millisecond data is, there's a huge cost difference. Same thing with security. There's a huge cost difference depending on what type of security you need. And so really defining these things up front are important, and making sure you're delivering the level of service that's required for that use case. And that gets back to the human aspect that I mentioned in my book, the human focus. It all starts not just with the strategy, but the human. Who are the human that's impacted? Who's the human that's using it? And what are the ramifications of each of those dimensions on the human for each of those dimensions?
100%. It's the human and it's the technology. And in AI IQ, you cover both the traditional AI ML and the new Gen AI. Seth, how do you see these technologies coexisting and complementing each other in organizations?
Yeah, I think that's an important part, right? I mean, just because we have this new school of AI, right? So post-2023 and the old school AI pre-2023 doesn't mean that we stop using the tools of the past, right? You know, machine learning has been around for 50 years, 70 years. Statistics has been around even longer. You need to make sure that when you identify the use case and when you identify the problem you're trying to solve, that you use the simplest possible solution. And sometimes the simplest solution is rules. If this, then that. And use that. Don't get fancy. It costs money to get fancy. And so in some cases, you should use generative AI. In some cases, you shouldn't. In some cases, you should use large language models. In some cases, you know what? Large language models probably aren't the answer for most generative AI solutions. Even the, you know, the generative AI is moving towards smaller models now. In most cases for business, it's going to be smaller models in the future because the large models are too expensive to run and maintain. And there's a lot of problems associated with them. And so make sure that you're using the right tool for the problem and not just jumping to the shiny box. This has been a problem for every hype technology, right? I mean, go back to mobile or blockchain or deep learning or whatever it is. It's, you know, how do I use, you know, everyone forgets about all the other technologies, right? When blockchain came out, everyone wanted to use blockchain. And well, that's, you know, you don't need blockchain for that. You just need a relational database, right? And so, you know, it's the same kind of thing with deep learning. That's not a deep learning problem. That's a logistical regression problem. So we're seeing the same thing with generative AI. We need to make sure that we're using the right tool to solve the right problem.
And I appreciate how you're bringing up these different tools because the themes are reoccurring. They've been here, as you mentioned, and they're continuing to show up. And that even is in ethics and in responsible AI. These as well are recurring themes. How can companies balance their innovation with the ethical considerations, especially for this rapidly emerging powerful technology like Gen AI?
I don't think there it's much of a balance even. I mean, I think it's first thing companies need to do is to define what their principles are. What are the things that you as an organization believe? You need to write those down as an organization and you need to state those internally and externally publicly so everyone knows where you stand and need to be crystal clear about them. And then you need to build policies and controls around those as an organization. And you need to, like we talked about earlier, right, build governance structure around it and make sure that there's escalation opportunities for your organization if it's not clear when they're within bounds. And then once you have those in place, there's not much of a balance. It's here's where you can innovate and here's where it's not appropriate to innovate. So I don't see it as a balance. I see it as setting appropriate guardrails and focusing innovation within those guardrails. You don't have to give up innovation to be responsible. I would argue that defining what responsible is clearly, defining what your ethical principles are clearly, actually focuses and accelerates innovation in a way that is aligned with your principles and your ethos.
Super fascinating. Thinking about ethics, thinking about the organization, thinking about the human. And there's so many projects that could be in flight. We're talking about Fortune 500 companies. And in the book, Seth, you emphasize the need for continuous AI readiness assessments. What are perhaps some early warning signs that an organization's AI initiatives might be going off track?
Fortunately, there's startups that are developing tools that to help kind of assess these now. But I think when you look at some signs that they're going off track is, you know, A, they're no longer aligned to the strategy. So you have AI projects that are tangential to what your business objectives are. You have a lot of technical debt in those projects. That's another thing that indicates they're going awry in terms of they weren't future-proof. So I talk a lot about future-proofing in the book as well, because the field is changing so fast that you need to make sure that as you're developing these assets, regardless of if they're physical or conceptual assets, they're future-proofed. And so, you know, if you're not building your systems in a way that accounts for change, that's a problem. If you're finding that your systems are going awry of compliance or new regulations, that's a problem. So those are three big indicators that you're going off track.
I think this is all so critical because we're thinking about the technology, the people, and the processes. And perhaps one of the big tie-ins in the book is that you're discussing fostering truly an AI-ready culture. For our audience here, what strategies have you found most effective for overcoming resistance to AI adoption within organizations?
Yeah, one of the biggest drivers for lack of adoption is a lot of times as organizations, when we're making changes, when we're trying to drive wholesale change in an organization, and this is not necessarily just related to AI, this is just in general, is we don't change the incentive structure for where we want to go. The incentive structure is still where we are. And so if we really want to change an organization, we need to change the incentive structure to incentivize people for the new organization. Because as humans, we're coin operated, right? We're going to do what we are rewarded for doing. So if we're rewarded to operate the same way we are, what we're doing today, that's what we're going to do. If we're rewarded to behave in a new way, that's what we're going to do. So that's probably one of the most important things you need to do is change your incentive structure. The other thing that organizations need to do is there needs to be a clear educational effort about the how and the why. So why is this important? How is this going to help the organization succeed? And this gets back to the business strategy and being able to clearly articulate to everyone in the organization how what they are doing contributes to what the head of the organization says to their shareholders at their quarterly or annual reports, right? So if the CEO or whomever is out talking to the street doing their quarterly earnings report, whoever is building the model or whoever is doing any job says, oh, I know how I contributed to that. Having that line of direct connectivity really helps with change because they are motivated by that because they know what they're, we know how they've contributed to the overall transformation. And then the other piece is honesty. A lot of times, you know, we talk about top line and bottom line value. Bottom line value usually means productivity gains, which usually means we're going to cut some jobs. And if you're not honest about that up front, and if, you know, that's going to hurt morale down the road. And so you need to be very honest up front and say, look, the whole goal of this project is we're going to reduce jobs. While we're developing this project, we're going to work on providing opportunities for people whose jobs are likely to be impacted to upskill, learn new things. We'll help them look for new opportunities in the company and we'll help them look for new opportunities outside the company. But you need to be very transparent with the people that are impacted because otherwise it will have a negative effect on the whole company because no one's going to feel comfortable and everyone's going to be scared of the transformation. Whereas if you're very clear and crisp about who's impacted, it helps everyone else feel more comfortable and it helps you people feel better about working for a company that takes care of their employees and is more honest with their employees when things like this happen.
Yeah, so thinking about change is something that is consistent. It's not always comfortable, but change is also in technology. And we're seeing, as you mentioned, Seth, 2023, right? It all changed with Gen AI. So if we could put a crystal ball looking ahead 5 to 10 years, you know, what do you believe will be the most significant challenges and opportunities for organizations in their AI journeys?
5 to 10 years. That's like a lifetime of AI, David. You know that.
Okay. We could shorten it to, you know, 1 to 3 years, perhaps.
All right. One to three years. That's easier. You know, I think the biggest challenge to organizations is going to still be how to adopt to all the change, because I think this field is still going to be changing so fast that organizations are going to have so many new things thrown at them all the time that they're not going to know which shiny object to grab onto if they're only looking at the shiny object. So if they're not looking at their strategy and taking the approach of how do we accelerate our business objectives and then how do we use technology to accelerate it, and looking for technology to help them accelerate their business objective, they're going to drown. If they keep looking at the technology and then trying to figure out how to sift through the technology and find the best technology and then look for a business problem, they're going to drown. So companies are going to be in about the same boat they are now because it just changes inevitably. It's just going to accelerate.
You're absolutely right. And that's the big tie-in of all the themes we've been discussing today from your book, AI IQ, right? We're looking ahead ultimately at AI IQ for a human-focused future, but there's so much more. I'm sure we've only touched the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, on themes here today. Seth, would you have any call to actions or closing remarks you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, just the important piece is, you know, the book is, as you said, it's really important to start with a strategy. So take a strategy first approach, not a technology first approach. You always really, really need to make sure that you consider the humans that are impacted and the humans that are using the systems. They may or may not be the same people. And the book came out 2 weeks ago. So head over to Amazon and buy yourself a copy.
Awesome. Well, this has been our session today with Seth Dobrin, who is the co-founder and GP of One Infinity Ventures and just released his new book, AI IQ for a Human-Focused Future. Seth, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me, David.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humane Podcast. Did the episode measure up to your thoughts on ML and AI, data science, developer tools, and technical education? Share your thoughts with me at humanepodcast.com/contact. Remember to share this episode with a friend, subscribe and leave a review, and listen for more episodes of Humane.